The presentation you are about to witness may startle you. It would not have been possible otherwise to sufficiently emphasize the frightful toll of the new drug menace, which is destroying the youth of America in alarmingly increasing numbers. Marijuana is that drug.
Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and on this episode, we are going to descend into madness, reefer madness in particular, with the creators of the show, Kevin Murphy and Dan Studney. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hello, hello.
Welcome. And we're going to talk about it because the new Los Angeles cast recording is now out and available. The CD came out on January 24th with two bonus tracks. So if you got the digital version, you are missing two tracks, which are available on the CDs. So you have to purchase the CD version to get those extra tracks, which is a terrific marketing ploy, by the way. Fantastic way to do that. The vinyl edition for you collectors of vinyl will be coming out in the spring. So that's something to look forward to. So before we get into Reefer Madness, why don't you guys tell the listeners how you guys originally connected and how you guys started working together?
Well, I was a high school, I was a college freshman, and I auditioned for the shows because I love theater. That was the thing that I did in high school. And I wanted to write with somebody who actually had a track record. And Dan was a year ahead of me, and he was the big deal with musical theater on campus because he had written and produced his own original musical. And I figured, like, all right, well, I should hook up with that guy because that guy can actually get things done. So I went to him and I proposed that we work together on Antigone as a sung through musical, sort of opera kind of thing. It was the late 80s, and that was, everybody was doing sung through musicals. That was like,
right,
pretty standard.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it, and it got produced, and we had such a good time that we did another one that got produced the following year. And then after doing television for a few years after graduating, we missed it, and we decided we would get together and write something new. And that ended up being Reefer Madness, and the rest is history 25 years later.
So talk about the story about how Reefer Madness came to be and why you picked it. I mean, I understand it has something to do with Frank Zappa. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Dan,
we were making an independent movie with a friend of ours up in the Oakland, San Francisco, Berkeley area. And we had a long drive back. And my musical education had not included very much Frank Zappa. So Kevin was like, let me turn you on to Zappa on this 5-hour trip. And so he's playing me Joe's Garage. I think the story goes that he was driving and I was in the passenger seat and I was reading the liner notes of the album and I was thinking, like, wouldn't it be fun to put this on stage? Like, Joe, somebody eventually did that, but it was a concept album. And I was like, this would be fun on stage. So I'm picturing Joe's Garage on stage with a band on stage. And all of a sudden I read something in the liner notes that said something about, maybe it was the liner notes, I can't remember, said something about Catholic schoolgirls smoking reefer behind the rectory, something like that. And I was just like, it just popped into my head. I'm visualizing a rock band on stage with a rock music, like a story. And then all of a sudden I was like, how come nobody's ever done Reefer Madness as a musical? That would be really cool. And there was just this long pause, and Kevin was like, how come nobody's ever done that?
And then the thing that's great about Reefer Madness is it ticks off a lot of boxes, because aside from the fact that it's the stupidest 68 minutes you're ever going to spend watching a movie, and by the way, it's a very long 68 minutes, that movie, but it's got a very simple boy meets girl love story at the center, which I think is an essential ingredient for a good lasting musical. It also is hugely operatic. The stakes are life and death. There's a reason for people to be singing, because they are experiencing like degradation and agony and ecstasy that can only be expressed through song. And there's something innately humorous about the entire concept, which is the weed merchant who lures in all the kids, that there's a really wonderful villain, and it really works really well as a, if you're sort of applying the template of what are the well-made small musicals.
Right.
I think there's also something about exploitation films like Reefer Madness that are so, that what we keyed into really early on was it works for musicals, because in musicals, one of the hardest things is how do you go from your book to your song? How do you smooth that out? And what it turns out with Reefer, it's like you take one puff and there's an orgy, you know? And so it's like, in many ways, we didn't have to deal with that ever. And I've never talked about this before, but I think I've never actually realized it before, but I think that was a benefit of this kind of thing.
Right. It is. It's a prime property to musicalize, which I don't think people, first off, if listeners are not familiar with Reefer Madness, the film was actually made in 1936. It's a really old movie, and it was actually made for serious purposes. It was made originally by a church group. And I think the original title, it was something like Tell Your Children. And it was for parents to teach, guiding parents to teach their children the evil of cannabis. And it was ultimately picked up by a distributor and turned into an exploitation film. And it's really bad. I mean, it's like really horribly made. And you're right. It's sort of like so over the top in terms of, you know, if you smoke marijuana, these horrible evil things instantly start happening to your life, including like hit and run driving and all, you know, all these murdering people and suicide and all these horrible things happen. And then it kind of faded away, and then suddenly had a reemergence in the 70s when people discovered this film, and it became a cult film. Because like you said, it's the most horrifying 68 minutes you'll ever experience, because it's so absolutely silly and over the top, but it's perfect for a musical.
I ought to leave him, but something makes me stay. It's the stuff. I try to kill him, but my guy gives me love and the stuff. Sometimes he's rough. He throws me down the stairs, but deep inside he cares. He buys me lingerie and the stuff. I was a student, good grades and so naive to the stuff. A handsome stranger, he swept me off my feet with the stuff. He was sweet at first, he began to change, and so my parents threw him out. After all, this house belonged to them. Then they had the accident. The brake line had been cut. No, not cut. The brake line simply broke. Those wire cutters that I found did not belong to Jack. I think I better take another tack. Just one more tack.
Once you picked on the property, and of course, by then the copyright had been totally screwed up, so it was totally public domain. Yep. to jump on.
That helped.
Yeah, that helps immensely at that point. But when you decided to sit down and write a score for this, I mean, what was the decision in terms of influences for what kind of music you wanted to, I mean, you needed to like figure out what was the era you were going to do musically for this?
We did set it in 1936, I think seven now, as we've rewritten it, but
right.
But
your musical style's not 36.
But for sure, we did not want to go the Kurt Vile, you know, right. Brecht standard 30s, you know, when musical style. And I love, you know, maybe taking a cue from something as silly as Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. You know, I love this idea that you could be in one style for 1 minute and then another style the other minute. And the other thing that I found fun about it, just composer wise, was the idea that you could separate when the happy kids are in the Five and Dime or they're singing Romeo and Juliet as the lovers. Anytime that's in the place, it's like it's swing dancing and it's fun and it's happy and it's wholesome. And then it's like when you're talking about the reefer and the stuff and the reefer madness of it all, it's the intrusion of the anachronistic electric guitar and the what was 25 years ago, the disco orgy, which is now more of an EDM crazy rave and, you mm-hmm. know, and with hip hop in it now and stuff. And so it's just the idea of being able to pull all these different things that you don't know what's coming next. I love that. And that was just that this was the perfect property for that because of its hallucinatory elements, I think.
The American Five and Dime, a place for young people to convene and dance to the popular tunes of the day. Although some of the modern steps might seem a bit risque. Most parents turn a blind eye, assuming it's all in good fun. But when the dancing's done, who shall pay the piper?
Cherry fizz in all of the land. My after school oasis gets the hopeless cases hopping and a bopping to the Five and Dime Band.
You can buy yourself a pack of smokes,
laugh at all my corny knock knock jokes.
Oh, gotta take the gang out to the local hangout.
I'm Jack.
Sometimes men come to call who stank up, seen in barber's hall, and ask kids if they felt at all like having themselves a few kicks. Oh,
I'm Jimmy. Pleased to meet you.
Jimmy? Like a Jimmy Cagney, eh?
Don't I wish.
Girl trouble, eh?
It's Mary. I've been trying to work up the nerve to give her my school ring on account of she's my best gal.
Well, that's some handcuff you got there. Real gold?
Paid for it with my paper route. Yeah, nothing but the best for my Mary.
Feel the crazy rhythm in your feet. Everybody keep it real petite. Blazing bright as neon, maybe we can be a major bulls amateur hour.
I've got just the cure. What say we blow this popsicle stand and find ourselves a real party, huh? I'll show you some of the new steps. Hey, hot fingers, let's tear it up. I'm through with you, you'll make Fred Astaire look like Barney Google. Come on, we'll have a few laughs. Half hour tops.
Well, if you're sure we'll only be a half hour...
Hey, that's a promise from me to you.
It's sort of like the musical, there's an inversely proportional relationship with the more wholesome the situation is, the more it feels like it could have been music in the 1930s, and the more degrading and horrible and marijuana-centric it gets, the more rock and roll the show gets.
Right.
So you have numbers like the Five and Dime, which
feels... Yeah, which is diegetic a little bit. But also the Five and Dime is interrupted by a dance from the villain, and you know, and that's another thing is that a lot of the music draws on more ethnic stuff that, you know, that when the villain's around, and when, you know, the happy little kids are, you know, being influenced by the jazz music and everything else, it's all kind of another level that the score is functioning on. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And how long did it take you guys to write this? Do you remember?
You mean the original?
Yeah.
Most of it was, we wrote a couple of songs just trying out. And then we decided, we were both working on a television show at the time. And which ironically was a syndicated version of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids that starred a 9-year-old boy named Thomas Decker, who plays Ralph as an adult in the current version of Reefer Madness. And we decided that we would take 2 weeks off to work on writing the show. And because I was in charge on the show, we were allowed to do that.
Right.
And then we went to Key West, and we just
got an Airbnb
and we wrote most of the show during that 2 week period.
This brownie is yummy. It's the greatest brownie known to man. It's chewy, it's nutty. This brownie's really good. Don't offer me a macaroon. My brownie suits me fine. There's frosting on the top, and best of all, it's mine.
Obviously, you had no concept at the time that this show was going to turn into what it turned into. But what did you envision for this at that time? What did you envision for this?
Let's write something we can self-produce in our own backyard, and something that we would want to watch over and over and over again. because that's what you have to do with musicals.
Right, exactly.
Back in the 90s, Los Angeles had a really, really rich $5 equity waiver theater scene that is kind of died out now because of union stuff. Mm-hmm. But it used to be that you could do something like Larry O'Keefe's Bat Boy. You could do a fairly sophisticated show with like a 4 or 5 piece band, and
right.
It didn't cost you an arm and a leg to actually do it. And, you know, and everyone involved kind of agreed, yeah, nobody's getting rich here. We're doing this because we live in a film and television world, and doing theater is a great way for us to show ourselves off and workshop, you know, whether you're an actor, whether you're a director, whether you're a writer, a way for people to kind of see what it is. And the, even though you may be getting paid $14 a show to appear in Reefer Madness, someone may come to see that show.
Right.
Suddenly you've got representation. Suddenly you're getting called in for an audition for something that's real money.
Right.
Yeah. And it also, we along that road, we would find, you know, like, holy crap, this person would want Bob Torty, Tony nominee for Starlight Express and Smokey Joe's and the Donny Osmond Joseph movie as the Pharaoh. That guy wants to be in my show. Like, we had just worked with the Money on Shrimp Kids, but you know, we were like, what about you doing this musical? And I couldn't believe he was just like, yeah, I'm in. And like, John Cassier, you know, grew up with him, Three Guys Naked from the Waist Down, all the, you know, the Crypt Keeper, all that stuff. It's like, he wants to be in the show. Are you kidding me? Like, it was just that was. That's where you start to realize, like, oh, maybe we have some good here. Like, all these is tracking all this wonderful.
And we also had young actors who had no credits who were looking to make the mark. Like, in our ensemble was Leslie Margarita before she was right. Leslie Margarita. It was just like,
yeah. Yes, I remember those days because I'm an LA native and I grew up doing theater here in LA. And oh. I remember the days in the 90s. It was really on fire here. I mean, the theater scene, yeah. Especially the small Equity Waiver, small, tiny theaters in Hollywood, like the Hudson, which is where this played, at the Hudson Theater, were things could really run. And I mean, how long did the show play? It opened in 1998 at the Hudson, and it played for a long time.
Yeah, it didn't open in 98. Everybody always
was
says
that. 98?
No, it was 99. This production in 2024, that was the 25th anniversary
right,
of the production.
Right.
But 98.
We did a big concert in late 98. And right, then we started rehearsing. And then Christian Campbell, bastard, got a pilot. And so we had to keep rehearsing for like 4 months.
Ah,
while we waited for Christian to finish his pilot.
So it opened, I think, in April of 99. Roughly.
And how long did it run at the Hudson? It was quite a long time.
Yeah, it ran for well over a year. I'm right. not exactly sure what
it was 100. We chose to stop it at it was exactly 150 shows, which is long. Which and that was like with 3 to 4 shows a week.
Right. And did you have any reason to believe that the show was going to have the life it had? Because it turned into such a cult musical that, I mean, because after LA, you're then off Broadway. In 2001.
Right.
And then you've got the film version, which happened in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
You then have the UK in 2009. Flash forward to 2014, where you have a big benefit concert in New York with an all-star cast, by the way. And then you have the 25th anniversary production last year in LA. Did you guys ever imagine that the show was going to have this kind of life at that point?
I mean, not when we were writing it and first producing it. I think once we got it up and running in Los Angeles, it was, you know, it was really well received and we got a lot of awards. So we were feeling kind of good about it. And then all of the good feelings about it sort of went quickly out the window because our off-Broadway production was downtown.
Right.
And we were in tech on 9/11.
Right.
And I'm not saying like the show might not have succeeded anyway, but certainly having the National Guard deployed along 13th Street, physically stopping people from coming to your theater because we were at the Variety Arts, which was just below 13th Street.
Right.
It didn't help.
Yeah, no, I understand. And the other thing I found really fascinating when I was doing a little bit of research is you guys, the show has like been ever evolving over time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you guys have not, you guys have shown a lot of dedication to the show in the sense that almost after every iteration of the show, whether it's been off Broadway or the film version, you've been making changes and taking songs out, putting songs in, and doing all sorts of changes to the show, right?
Yep.
We've learned a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think also having, you know, another career doing television and film, that you learn a lot about editing and economy of language and economy of situation, that a lot of things that when you're a writer starting out, you think you've got to put all of the pieces out there for the audience, so they're not going to follow what's going on. And I think the way you discover doing anything in a filmed medium is that as you're manipulating that footage, you can tell the same story with a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
I think that idea of you know, the adage, you know, the Sondheim, like less is more, is you know, is really applicable. And I think that you learn that through experience.
I mean, Kevin's more of Sondheim. I'm more of an Antonin Artaud. You know, I know he died in an insane asylum, but he but I'm more of a No More Masterpieces guy. Don't be precious with your work.
My mommy never named me. I guess she was too high. My tummy would get rumbly. I'd cry and cry and cry. She hopped her rings to pay for weed. She modeled in the nude and sold me to a factory. And now I'm puppy food. La la la.
You'd be surprised how many American babies we lose this way.
Now we're going to flash forward to last year, 2024. Talk about how this anniversary production came about, and you and about your all-star lineup of producers.
Well, it started with Christian Campbell really had a vision for bringing this show back, and he wanted to bring it back very specifically to Los Angeles, because that was sort of the site of our greatest thing. And for all the people involved with the show, Reefer Madness was a big deal for us. You know, it was sort of how a lot of us, you know, first made our mark. And to that end, we would have a regular kind of every 6 months or so, a bunch of alums we would get together. It would be Bob Torti from the original cast and from the movie in New York, John Kassir, Christian, Dan, and myself, director Andy Fickman, and Kristen Bell, who was not in the original LA cast, but she joined our New York cast when she was still a student at NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us had kind of become family, and everybody was sort of there at, you know, birthdays and baptisms of each other's kids and all kinds of stuff like that. And Christian was kind of talking about how he really wanted Reefer Madness to kind of come back. And Kristen Bell just sort of blurted out, "I'm in. What do I need to do?"
Mm-hmm.
And she joked later, she's like, "I'm not actually sure that any of you actually asked me to be involved, but I just really..."
She forced her way in.
Yes.
So you know, so
that's also how she got frozen, by the way. No, it's chaos.
So talking about that, we really just kind of came to the idea of let's see if we can get some investors. Let's see if we can find a space. And in anticipation, Dan and I took the show, which used to be 2 hours and 20 minutes with an intermission and two acts. And let's really look at what's critical. And let's use all of that experience that we have doing filmed medium that I talked about. And we managed to squish the show down to a 90-minute running time. And that was adding three songs and doing it without an intermission. And then when we actually started it in Los Angeles, Kristen Bell's wonderful note was, "Yeah, you know what? It still feels like it's too long. Can we take more cuts?" And so Dan and I, heartbreakingly, we had written two brand new songs for the new production. It was going to be something special. And it was very clear. Those were the two songs that were not landing with the audience the way everything else was. And it had a ripple effect elsewhere in the show. So as an experiment, we cut
for
no 90-minute show. No, we cut an additional 8 minutes out. And the next night the show just was on fire and it was great. And it was like, so it turns out 82 minutes is just about the right length for Reefer Madness, the musical.
Right. And it was an immersive production, right? more of immersive.
Yeah. Right. Dan, you want to talk about that?
Sure. I mean, one of the most amazing things that happened to us was you know, I've known Spencer Liff, I don't know, maybe 25 years or so. I've always wanted to work with him. And just by happenstance, he came on board as a choreographer for a workshop that we did. And then we were just like, why don't we just let him direct and choreograph the thing? Because he really, really has a vision for this. And, and we owe him a lot. I mean, first of all, his choreography is just superb. And, and he was on board to do this whole immersive, crazy thing where it's right up in your face. And so I credit a lot to Spencer. And also we brought on board a really wonderful musical director, David Lamoureux, who took my new orchestrations and did them for real with David Catalan and brought in this one. You'll hear the album. The music sounds better than it's ever sounded. And so, what was your question? You said we could go off a...
Yeah, you can go off on tangents. The album is one. The album is terrific. It's a wonderful cast recording, which... that's the best part is you get this 25th anniversary production and you get a new album, because there have been albums in the past. There was a soundtrack and the original cast recording, and now you get a brand new cast recording. So talk about how that came about, because that's now available from Yellow Sound.
It came about because we had like 3 or 4 days with this amazing cast, and we realized, oh, fuck, we have no plan to record this. We need to record this cast and lock them down. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't budgeted for it. So Dan and I were like, well, you know what? We've spent money on stupider things. So we decided to basically self-fund it. And we got very lucky because the amazing Michael Kreuter from Yellow Sound had worked with us, worked with me and with director Andy Fickman doing both of the Heathers albums. And he got a lot of people who were enormously talented to work for a friends and family rate to make it possible for us to self-produce this album. And it just came out. I'm so proud. And it just, one of my favorite days in theater was when we came for Circle, and we told the cast we're recording this, and just watching all of these young folks, because with the exception of one member of our cast, it's the first cast album for every single actor on here. And
right.
For David Lamoureux, who did our arrangements and musical direction, it's his first big, the thing that he's doing on an album. And to be able to do that for these young actors is like, you know what? I've spent stupider money.
Yeah, right. I think there's also something to be said for when you've made changes like this, especially in music orchestrations, especially like has changed so significantly. And this stuff has a big new middle part, and Murder has a big new middle. There's lots of a couple of things here and there across the show. You also want to. When I was a kid, the only way I was directing musicals. And how I would find them would be cast albums, And so it's interesting for me to like want to lock down what we've done here, which is the new version of the show, which is going forward what we will license through Concord and things like that, so that people know what the show sounds like and can get inspired by it to give it a life after this production.
Forsooth, fair Juliet, wouldst thou likest yon hot chocolate?
Oh, Jimmy! Wherever did you learn to speak like that?
It's fancy talk from Romeo and Juliet. Oh. Because when a guy wants to woo a girl, he needs, the right language.
Are you trying to woo me, Jimmy Harper?
I need words to tell you about my pounding heart. $4 words that make a guy sound smart. Well, I guess that's why they invented Shakespeare. His articulations of a lover's palpitations are so keen. My bounty is as boundless as the sea. My love as deep the more I give to thee.
Oh, you sound so dreamy when you talk like Shakespeare.
A big vocabulary should be customary when you fall in love.
La 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 la, you're a snowy dove.
La la la, pretty.
marriage is birth of love.
La 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 la, hip hooray for Shakespeare. Sure as I am breathing, you can make Elizabethan language fun.
Like a jewel upon the cheek of night. Hark, what light through yonder window breaks here? We'll be future spouses, put a plague on both our houses if we're wrong. Shakespeare!
Now that this is in the CD form, it's in CD form, it's in the can, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And hopefully Reefer Madness is now put to rest for a while. are you guys working on anything together? That's new that we can look forward to.
We're actually focused on getting Reefer Madness to the next level.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
When we were there, we got permission from Equity, and we did a pro shot as an archival that sort of reflects the immersive nature of it. Mm-hmm. It will never be commercially available for sale, but we're using it as a tool to try to get other producers interested in doing the show.
Oh, great.
So we're gonna see what happens there.
Oh, terrific. Yep. That's great. Wonderful. I want to encourage listeners to check out the new Los Angeles cast recording of Reefer Madness, available on Yellow Sound. You can purchase a digital download, but I recommend purchasing the CD because you're gonna get two bonus tracks. What bonus tracks are they gonna get? Do you guys know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's Cautionary Tale, which is the hardest thing I've ever had to cut, and Kindergarten Teacher. It's the two songs that we cut from the show, but the performers, Jaylene Marcos and Anthony Norman, respectively, just knocked those songs out of the park, and we wanted to put them on the album. So
one song is kind of a charm song, va-va-voom, crowd pleaser with Sally. And we get to deepen her character. We learn a little bit more about her backstory and who she was before she was a reefer slut. And then Cautionary Tale is Jimmy questioning everything that he's been taught and everything that he's been fed. And it kind of, it's a song that's sort of like the thematic signature of the show. The problem is we already had a thematic signature with The Truth, and we sort of were double pumping a finale. And long story short,
also our instinct was Jimmy needs an 11 o'clock number. And what we didn't realize until it was up on his feet is that May already has the 11 o'clock number when she rips Jack's heart out and sings the stuff for Priest. And so it was like, once you rip the villain's heart out, you really can't have two songs in a row before you're over and you're done. And so as hard as it was to cut that, one interesting thing for people who want to go on a Easter egg hunt, we had a little bit of I had back written into some of the orchestrations, the underscore, some of the music from Cautionary Tale. So the show actually kind of opens, it's not on the album, but it opens a little theme from Cautionary Tale. And when Jimmy takes his first hit, if you listen to that song, there's an extended sequence that's unique to this production, and it's got Cautionary Tale in it. But then you never now hear Cautionary Tale in the show. So it's a rather like We'll Have Tomorrow at the end of Don't Feed the Little Shop of Horrors and Don't Feed the Plants, when they go, We'll Have Tomorrow and Don't Feed the Plant. And you're like, oh, there was a whole song called We'll Have Tomorrow. So there's a little Easter egg for you.
There you go. Well, Kevin and Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk about Reefer Madness. So
absolutely. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Please pick up the CD, and you'll get the wonderful, wonderful album cover art by everybody's favorite Broadway artist, Squiggs.
Yep.
Who did the art, which is wonderful. So congratulations, you guys.
Thank you. Yeah, that was awesome.
Little Mary Sunshine,
with her hen got so low. Little Mary Sunshine with her ducks in a row.
It burns my lungs.
Little Mary Sunshine needs a change in her life.
My head feels funny, Ralph.
Little Mary Sunshine needs a man. Now come on, Mary Sunshine, it's time that you learn to be bad. You make a charming armful, so snuggle up my buttercup, cause you've been had.
I think you tricked me.
Now smoke it, Mary Sunshine, dissolve in the sweet burning glow. Come lose yourself in pleasure. When the bumble lunch has got you, you'll be raring to go.
Oh no, I can't. What about Jimmy's
a rube, provincial and dull. Don't be tricked, he's strictly quadrilateral.
Up and down and up and down and
down again.
Ooh, little Mary Sunshine, you are ultra, ultra.
I feel a little naughty.
Baby, I'll help you relax.
I'll tie you up with fur cord. We'll play with whips and nipple clips and get wax.
Hold on, Mary Sunshine. Let's not get carried away.
Just call me.